is Monday, June 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan wins a big election victory. We get a firsthand account of the situation on the U.S.-Mexico border, and a Michigan Muslim American candidate hopes to win election to the U.S. Congress. It's all ahead. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has secured his hold on power, winning more than 52% of the vote in which was the country's most contested presidential and parliamentary election in recent years. Speaking to thousands of supporters at his AKP headquarters in Ankara in a pre-dawn appearance Monday, Erdogan described Sunday's election as a victory for democracy.
Kardeşlerim. Bu seçimin galibi.
He said the winner of this election is democracy, our nation. The winners of this election are every one of the 81 million citizens. I want to thank you all who went to the polls today in this democracy festival, which has had the highest turnout in our history. Erdogan now assumes the sweeping new powers passed in a 2017 constitutional referendum, which was marred by fraud allegations. Reporter Dorian Jones is in Istanbul. I asked him why Erdogan was successful in defeating the opposition.
Well, that is a lot of big question that the opposition are asking. They really felt that they did have a real chance of at least preventing him from securing an overall majority in the first round and forcing a runoff. But I think what has been revealed is the case that over Erdogan's 16 years in power, his supporters have proved to be remarkably loyal. They believed in many ways that the benefits and rights, particularly the religious section of Turkish society, have benefited under Erdogan, and they fear if he were to leave power, those rights would be at risk. And I think in many ways, this loyalty has underscored Erdogan's 16 years in power. But it has to be said that loyalty was put to the test in this election. He fought a very lackluster campaign, very uncharacteristically. He's normally a giant of campaigning, not this time. And this campaign was dominated by economic concerns following heavy falls in the currency and emergency rates hikes in interest rates. Despite all that, he still prevailed.
Because I have read, though, that his supporters like what he's doing with the economy.
Well, the economy has been very robust in growth, and Turkey has one of the fastest growing economies in the world at around 7%. But up until the last few months, there is growing concerns that the major economic storms are on the horizon. The Turkish currency has been seen as extremely vulnerable, and that's because the government have borrowed hundreds of billions of dollars to finance these huge mega projects, which have provided a lot of jobs, a lot of construction, but at the same time have run up Turkey's debt and made the currency vulnerable. And that's what happened. The currency plummeted heavily, investors have lost confidence, and Turkey now has among the highest interest rates in the world. And the expectation in the coming months, Turkey will be heading to a recession. But that recession hasn't hit Turkey yet. And many people believe that that is why Erdogan called snap elections 18 months early to avoid being running in an economic recession. And that is another factor why why his voters did stay remain loyal, because he has delivered jobs and prosperity for 16 years, and they still believe his promises that he will continue to do so.
Now, apparently he will be assuming new executive powers. How will his rule change?
Well, President Erdogan is set to be probably the most powerful elected leader in the world. He will be able to rule by decree, which have the force of law. He appoints all the ministers who are now directly accountable to him. He also chooses most of the country's top judges. And Parliament's role has been severely diminished. The role of Prime Minister has gone. So there are seen to be very few checks to his power. Erdogan insists, though, he's democratically elected, and these new sweeping powers will allow him to carry out the wishes of the electorate. The opposition say this is tantamount to an elected dictatorship.
There have been crackdowns on his political opponents as well as on journalists. Is that something that is expected to continue?
Well, President Erdogan, in his victory address, said the war against Turkey's terroristic threats would continue. And since the 2016 failed coup, we have seen tens of thousands of arrests, over 100 journalists in jail, More than 200,000 people have lost their jobs, although some have been reinstated under the ongoing crackdown. But Erdogan has promised that there will be no let-up in this. Critics say that much of this crackdown hasn't been aimed at people who are conspiring against the government, but genuine critics. The government dispute that, but the message from the president is the crackdown will continue.
The founder of modern Turkey, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, formed a secular country. Is Erdogan continuing that, or is he rolling back on that?
Well, that certainly has been the case in the early years of his rule. He did break down many controls, for example, banning the women of wearing headscarves in public places, state institutions like universities and law courts. That was feared to be posing a greater risk of an Islamization of the country. But others argue this is purely about religious freedom. But going forward, we have seen in the recent years a massive expansion in religious schools. They're called Imam Hatips. There are talks that they possibly could convert the whole education to this kind of religious education. That has caused a lot of concern. But it has to be said, there is voices of criticism coming from his own ranks about that direction the country is going in. It's unclear whether Erdogan will continue to pursue that route. Little has been said in his victory address about that. And that is something that certainly with the sweeping powers he has, there will be concerns how he uses those and the question of the future of the secular state.
Dorian Jones reporting from Istanbul. Meanwhile, an election observation mission found Monday that enough voters had a genuine presidential election in Turkey. The conditions for campaigning were not equal. The Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe said in a preliminary statement Monday the incumbent enjoyed undue advantage, including an excessive coverage by government-affiliated public and private media outlets. In a joint statement released later, EU diplomatic chief Federica Mogherini and enlargement commissioner Johan Hahn cited the results of the mission, refusing to congratulate Turkey's president without referring to him by name. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. Ethiopia says the United States will send federal investigators to probe a deadly blast in Addis Ababa. A search continues in Thailand for missing teenagers and a coach in a flooded cave. And the location of a sunken Indonesian ferry has been identified. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists say our sun has been shining for about the last 4.5 billion years. The sun is expected to have enough hydrogen fuel in its core to shine for about another 5 billion years. Along with producing solar energy, this nuclear fusion is creating helium. Once the sun runs out of hydrogen, it will start fusing the helium and begin another 5 billion year process that will eventually result in the sun's death. The helium fusion process will cause the sun to expand and transform itself into a red giant star. According to a new study, as the red giant expands, it will lose mass and expel gas and dust, which will form a massive glowing ring called a planetary nebula. The sun will be a white dwarf by then and will eventually die. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, a Muslim American woman wants to represent Michigan in the U.S. Congress. We'll have a report. President Donald Trump on Monday again assailed judicial review for illegal border crossers, contending that the migrants ought to immediately be sent back to their homelands. The American Civil Liberties Union said Sunday that the U.S. leader's call to end legal hearings for undocumented immigrants seeking asylum in the U.S. was unconstitutional. But Trump rejected that view in a pair of Twitter comments. He wrote, "Hiring many thousands of judges and going through a long and complicated legal process is not the way to go. Will always be dysfunctional." He said people must simply be stopped at the border and told they cannot come into the U.S. illegally. He contended that if children and their parents are sent home, illegal immigration will be stopped in its tracks, and at very little by comparison cost. This is the only real answer, and we must continue to build the wall. The United States for years has granted court hearings to migrants fleeing violence in Mexico and Central American countries and from elsewhere in the world, and those who are looking for better economic fortunes in the United States. Last week, Trump signed an executive order maintaining his zero-tolerance policy of detaining and prosecuting everyone entering the country illegally, but ending the practice of separating immigrant parents and children. VOA immigration reporter Eleni Barros has just returned to Washington from spending last week at the U.S.-Mexico border in Brownsville and McAllen, Texas. I asked her for her impressions of conditions in those border towns.
First of all, thanks for having me. I appreciate you having me. The overall thoughts, it's, well, you get there, first of all, when you get to a port of entry, you think there's this line of people trying to come in, and that's not what I saw. When we were in Brownsville at the port of entry there, it's a small town, folks coming in and out, you know, the U.S., you see cars with Mexican tags, you see cars with Texans tags going over the border. You see people coming for shop, like they will go to Walmart. I saw people going to Ross, you know, those small clothing stores that they're there, and just regular folks, you know, crossing the bridge and being part of the economical aspect of that local small town.
So they go back and forth.
That's what I saw. Yes. Okay. Yes.
Now, the people, though, that are coming, the migrants, they are not Mexican. They are from Central America, most of them?
Well, most of them. You still have some Mexicans trying to cross, but the overall people coming are from Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala. And a lot of the stories are, you know, I heard from a father saying, I asked him, why did you come? And he said, there's a lot of evil. There's a lot of gangs, and I wanted a better future for my son. A mother that I spoke with, I asked her if she had heard about all the things that's happening, and she said, if I had known about this journey, I wouldn't have come. It was really hard. Then another mother who said that she would do it all over again because her kids, they're what matter to her. So we think that, you know, there's this perception that they know what's happening here, that they know that their kids may be taken away, that they know the journey is very complicated and difficult. But for the people that we interview, they actually do not know. They understand it will be difficult, but they don't know what to expect. And I'll give you an example. One of the fathers that we spoke with, he was with his 16-year-old, and he said that he got robbed when he got to Mexico. And then when he tried to cross over, you know, the bridge and get there and ask for help, he wasn't allowed to. So he came back, and the coyotes, which, you know, those are people who are sort of like observing you, see if you're trying to cross, and then they'll come to you and say, hey, I can cross you, just pay me X amount of money. So one of these people approached the group that he was with. When they got to the border, literally to cross over the river, the guy robbed him again and the group that he was with. And at that moment, when he's telling me the story, I mean, you can see the anxiety. You can see how emotional he got. His words exactly in Spanish were, I thought that something bad was going to happen at that moment. So literally, the people, I can't speak for everyone, but the people who we interviewed, they had no idea. They didn't understand that they would go to detention, for instance.
Okay.
They simply didn't understand that. Another perception that I sort of think that some people have is that they understand what asylum is. I asked a few people, so do you plan to apply for asylum? And all of them, and those are people in different moments of the trip, right? One interview on Tuesday, the other one interview on Wednesday. Their answer was, what's asylum? Can you tell me more about this? So they don't even understand that could be this possibility of staying in the U.S. if they claim credible fear. So we have this perception that they come here with a plan, that they know what they're going to do, that they're going to detention. The people that I spoke with simply had no idea.
Were you able to get near any of the detention facilities?
Yes, yes. We went to the one in Brownsville from Southwest Key Programs, where more than 1,400 minors, boys, are being held there. We walked around. There's quite a police presence there. They're driving and cruising to make sure that you don't go near the door, because you cannot even go near the door, believe it or not. There's keep out signs all around this big parking lot, because it used to be a Walmart. So you can see this huge warehouse. everything closed. There's no windows. There's no glass doors. You cannot see through anything. It's very well protected. The parking lot is pretty packed. There are cars everywhere. So there's a lot of people either working or visiting that place. There is a small shopping center around. So you have a pizza place. You have a McDonald's. You have a sandwich place. So you have people there, you know, that sort of depend on the employees working at this detention center. We went inside of the businesses, one of the small businesses, and we said, well, how would you see it? And he told, he didn't want to go on camera with us, but he did say, well, you see those vans, they are the ones that transport the children. We see them driving this around. Every time there's a new one, we'll come and we see the kids going inside of the warehouse. And a lot of the business that we are able to have it here is because of this detention facility.
VOA immigration reporter Alini Barras. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. Bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. About 100 Muslim Americans are running for public office this year, many of them Democrats, hoping to be a part of a blue wave in the congressional midterm elections in November. VOA's Kane Faraba has been following one former Michigan state legislator who has her eyes on making it to the U.S. Congress, so much so that she was out on the campaign trail all through the month of Ramadan. He found that she's focusing less on her gender and her religion and more on addressing the needs of the community she seeks to represent.
It's crazy.
Through the hottest hours.
Yeah, I need to invest in a swimming pool.
On blistering pavement that could fry an egg.
God, nobody has sprinklers on today.
Rashida Tlaib is walking door to door in this Detroit neighborhood in search of votes.
Yeah, so this is going to be a pretty competitive Democratic primary.
And she's doing so without eating any food or drinking any water during the day. That's because Tlaib is a practicing Muslim, which means she is fasting during the holy month of Ramadan.
I know that my faith comes up more on social media because they're not face to face with me, but on the doors, I don't get it as much.
While others would stay indoors in the air conditioning, Tlaib views it as an opportunity to build name recognition as she seeks to represent Michigan's 13th district in the U.S. Congress.
People still can't pronounce my name, but they remember what I've done, and they remember that I've come to their home.
Tlaib is no stranger to politics, having served in Michigan's state legislature. She is the daughter of Palestinian immigrants, but on these Detroit streets, in a predominantly African-American neighborhood, she is a local, someone who was born here and attended schools in the area.
But it's that direct connection to the neighborhood that I think people are much more excited about.
She acknowledges few of the people she meets realize she is on the cusp of making history again.
And I tell them, you know, I'm the first Muslim woman ever elected in the Michigan legislature, and if elected in this congressional race, I'll be the first ever in Congress.
Is she a shoo-in? No. Is she a possibility? Yes, she is. She is a formidable candidate.
Osama Siblani is the publisher of the Dearborn, Michigan-based Arab American News, a weekly publication targeting the large Arab American population in southeastern Michigan. He says Tlaib's candidacy and that of two other races prominently featuring Muslim Americans in Michigan shows a new political awakening in the community.
We were at one time in hiding, you know. We were changing our names in this country. And despite September 11, despite the Trump era, You know, we are moving forward.
This is a pretty historic campaign. People that are supporting me from this Muslima in Tampa who's like, please win, because if you win, we belong. And I'm telling her, we've already won. You absolutely belong. It means so much bigger than me.
For Tlaib to win, she will need support outside the Arab American community in Michigan, most of whom don't live in the district she seeks to represent and can't vote for her. Tlaib faces several challengers seeking to replace Congressman John Conyers Jr., who resigned in December amid allegations of sexual misconduct. The winner of the August 7th Democratic primary will likely head to Congress next year, as there is currently no Republican running in the November general election. Cain Faerbaugh, VOA News, Detroit, Michigan.
That is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The governments of the United States, the United Kingdom, and Norway have called on all warring parties in Darfur to lay down their arms and work with international peacekeepers to achieve a permanent peace. In 2003, armed opposition in the Darfur region of Western Sudan began an insurrection against the government in Khartoum in protest against government policies that they claim discriminated against non-Arabic populations. The government sent troops to fight the uprising and also armed militias, the Janjaweed, to fight the rebels. But the Janjaweed were more interested in brutalizing the civilian population, resulting in a humanitarian crisis that left hundreds of thousands dead and 2 million people displaced. In 2007, a combined African Union United Nations hybrid operation in Darfur, or UNAMID, was deployed in Darfur to stabilize the region. Several ceasefire agreements were signed, as well as two peace agreements in 2006 and 2011. However, two of the major opposition groups, Justice and Equality Movement Jibril Ibrahim and the Sudan Liberation Army Abdul Wahid, or SLA-AW, refused to sign the agreement. SLA-AW has consistently rejected participation in any peace agreement, refused to declare any unilateral cessation of hostilities, and is engaged in confrontations with government forces. Hostilities began anew in March, and the government increased its troops and intensified the fighting. Finally, in mid-June, Sudanese government forces and the Sudan Liberation Movement Abdel Wahid clashed in central Darfur state, again forcing thousands of civilians to flee their villages. On June 19th, the governments of the United States, the United Kingdom, and Norway issued a written statement condemning the fighting, as well as intertribal violence in the Jebel Mara region of Darfur. The civilian population continues to bear the brunt of this unnecessary violence, which has led to the burning down of villages, causing high numbers of civilian injury and death, and the displacement of nearly 9,000 people, said the statement. There can be no military solution to the conflict in Darfur, and the international community should consider imposing sanctions against those who continue to act as spoilers. The three governments call on all parties to the conflict to immediately cease all military engagement and hostilities, allow unfettered humanitarian access, and to meaningfully engage with the African Union High-Level Implementation Panel-led peace process in order to reach a permanent ceasefire. The United States continues to engage all parties to the conflict to exercise restraint, engage in dialogue for a negotiated solution.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.